We don't have much information from the Spirit of Prophecy, none that I know of, about the first four trumpets, but the last three we have a little bit of information. We actually have a great deal on the sixth trumpet, and therefore, as a result of that, also on the fifth trumpet related to the sixth, and as a result of that, a little bit on the seventh. And so we put the three together, as we did last week, on the seals. If you look in Revelation chapter 8, and we want to read verses 2, 3, and 4, and 5, and I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. And again, now we have heavenly beings around the throne. Remember, we started back in Revelation chapter 4 and chapter 5, where it talks about the four living creatures, the 24 elders, following the Lamb in the midst of the throne, and first of all, of course, the Heavenly Father there seated on the throne in Revelation chapter 4. Now it speaks of these seven angels. It seems that all of these beings are involved in the work for men, for the churches, the seals, the trumpets, whatever you're talking about, have something to do with us and the preaching of the gospel and the great controversy in the earth. And so all this is of heaven is engaged in our salvation and in the warfare of the great controversy, and this is part of it. Verse 3 said, I saw, and another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. There was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints on the golden altar, which was before the throne. As we study this from Adventist commentary, we find out this was Christ. This is one special angel. Other angels also have incense, we understand. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. Now notice the change in verse 5. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it into the earth. Now no incense. Took the censer and he filled it with fire off the altar. The fire on the altar was holy fire. Fire that had come from heaven, literally. And he filled the censer with fire and he cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and earthquake. And then he talks about the seven trumpets. So in the light of this, it appears that there are some of the wrath of the Lord depicted here in this gesture of casting the censer filled with fire into the earth. And perhaps it has much to do with these trumpets and what transpired later on. I wish you'd notice very briefly in the first four trumpets the unique things that are used here in destruction upon the earth. Hail, fire, mingled with blood in verse 7. Hail and fire mingled with blood. Come down, the second angel, a great mountain burning with fire, was cast into the sea. Down to the third angel, verse 10, fell a great star from heaven, burning as were a lamp, and so on. And as you continue reading the fourth angel, third part of the sun was smitten, a third part of the moon, a third part of the stars. These seem to be talking about heavenly, supernatural acts. Isn't that right? Involving great powers of some kind. Very unusual things taking place here. I've read interpretations of it many times, but I wonder how accurate they are. But we do know about the fifth and the sixth. And the reason we know about it is because of this prophecy is discussed in the book Great Controversy at great length. Back in the days of the Advent movement, they had many arguments. They didn't argue about the Sabbath because they still didn't believe in the Sabbath. The greatest argument, of course, raged over whether Christ would come before the millennium or afterward. Seventh-day Adventists were the first premillennialists in existence, at least as a denomination. When William Miller began to preach that Christ would come before the millennium, there were no such believers as that. He was the first one we knew of. Today, almost everyone is a premillennialist, no matter what denomination. But Seventh-day Adventists don't get the credit for it. I don't like that. I don't think it's fair. Everyone said we were wrong in the 1830s, and now everyone says we're right. We were called a pessimistic sect back there because we looked for a cataclysmic destruction at the coming of Christ, you see, and a doomsday. People didn't like that. When I was a boy, they still didn't like it. Can you remember? They're talking about utopia in the 1920s and 30s. The earth was getting better and better. Everyone was getting better and better, and soon we're going to have the bright and happy day of heaven on earth. And every magazine and newspaper and book was saying this. And to be a Seventh-day Adventist, you really were a pessimist in those days. It wasn't a very pleasant thing to be an Adventist then. Now, suddenly, after the dropping of a hydrogen bomb, the atomic bomb, and developments of these things, you know, and the ecology problems and the crime problems and all the rest that you can name, suddenly everyone says that we're going to destroy this place, you know, and everyone in it. So suddenly everyone believes now in a premillennial advent of Christ. They really do. Not exactly as we do, but They believe this now. An old Baptist minister's wife told me that she was shocked at a Southern Baptist convention 20-some years ago when she sat there at ordination of some young men in the Southern Baptist faith in their convention and heard them question before the entire audience of several thousand people. And they're asked, do you believe in a premillennial advent of Christ? She's a minister's wife, and she knew doctrines and knew them well. She told me that she was shocked when they asked these men that question. She'd never heard it asked before of a minister in the Southern Baptist denomination. Now, of course, everyone believes that way. We have believed this way, of course, since our beginning. This was one argument. Another argument was over these prophecies that William Miller preached and others did as well. It seemed far-fetched to most people that a day would stand for a year in Bible prophecy. And even though it worked out so logically, you know, and it fitted history so perfectly, still they doubted that this could be true. And the thing that settled the argument once and for all was the predictions of a man called Josiah Litch, and most of you read about him, I think, in great controversy. He was interested in the Mohammedan powers, the Turkish nations, the Seljuk and the Ottoman empires discussed in Revelation chapter 9. You notice verses 5 and 10, first of all, under the fifth angel sounding his trumpet. And to them it was given they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. 5 months. Verse 10 mentions the same time. And it says they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. If you're a student of Bible prophecy, you know that we believe that a day stands for a year in prophetic time. And we believe in the business calendar of the Middle East and of the Jews, which had 30 days to a month. And so 5 times 30 is 150 days or 150 years. And he was following this very controversial issue at that time, that a day would stand for a year in Bible prophecy. So he assumed that in prophetic time this would be 150 years that this power would rule. Then you come to the sixth angel in Revelation 9, from verses 13 to the end of the chapter. In verse 15, you find another prophecy, perhaps one of the most complicated in all the Bible so far as the time element is concerned. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. Hour, a day, a month, and a year. Figuring a day for a year, and it's quite easy, and I hope you're good at mental arithmetic, a day, an hour, is 1/24th part of a day. If a day stands for a year, then an hour is 1/24th part of a year. 1/24th of a year is 15 days. Multiply 15 times 24, and you'll get 360 in prophetic time. They go by a business calendar. A day then would be 1 year, an hour a day. A month would be 30 days or 30 years. So now you've got 31 years and 15 days. And then it says a year, which would be 360 days or years. So you get 391 days, 391 years, 15 days. This is the prophecy. This man, Josiah Litch, sat down and studied this at great length, read history books. And by the way, you have never really done research and just to sit down to study prophecies and research the history books. Just studying, 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 studying. For if you start to study this chapter alone, you'll find out the Mohammedans were everywhere, it seemed like to me. Not just in Turkey, but they're in Palestine. You can study about the relationship of this to Palestine, which I've been doing for the last month or so. They're in North Africa, all across North Africa. They're in the Middle East, and they were going over into the East, many places over there. The Mohammedans just spreading out every direction. You know, the Mohammedans went to Spain, you know that. Mohammedans went to the Philippines in the Far East in those days. They just literally were girding the earth with their religion. Mohammedanism was not a small little sect hidden in the corner someplace, but it became greater and mightier, and literally it was going around the earth for hundreds of years. And it was a major threat to Christianity. Christianity was the only one supposed to do that. And here, what we call a heathen religion was doing this, you see, and actually putting Christianity to shame for a while. As you begin to think about the enormous progress of Mohammedanism, you begin to see how it could possibly fit in the great controversy and how it became a threat to Christianity and its growth, supposed to going to all the world, you see, at that time. Now, Josiah Litch studied this and had been studying for some time. In 1838, he came to the conclusion that in just a couple years, this prophecy of the sixth angel would be fulfilled. This one of 391 years, 15 days. And so he wrote a little tract, and he published it, and it's put in print, and we still have some of the originals in our libraries today. They're not all lost, and the dates are still on them, so you can read them, I understand. And he put this in print, establishing that a day would stand for a year, predicting an event before it came to pass, using these two Bible prophecies of Revelation chapter 9. It's as though someone today would say, in 1974, in the month of August, and then later on a certain date, Russia would fall. Something comparable to that. Russia would no longer be communistic. Might become Christian or something else, or democratic. And actually, it was outlining to that, for the Ottoman Empire was a tremendous empire. And he was predicting something about it. Now, let me read you from Great Controversy what he had to say about it, since you understand what it is. Found on pages 334 and 335. In the year 1840, another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy excited widespread interest. 2 years before, Josiah Litch, one of the leading ministers preaching the Second Advent, published an exposition of Revelation chapter 9, predicting the fall of the Ottoman Empire. According to his calculations, this power was to be overthrown in AD 1840, sometime in the month of August. Now, 2 years in advance, he wrote this, published it, so he was obligated, you see. And only a few days previous to its accomplishment, he wrote, allowing the first period of 150 years to have been exactly fulfilled before Decozes ascended the throne by permission of the Turks, and that the 391 years 15 days commence at the close of the first period, it will end on the 11th of August 1840, when the Ottoman Empire in Constantinople may be expected to be broken. And this, I believe, will be found to be the case. The man wrote. You can go back and check history about it. Of course, it's very accurate now. And as he finishes, she quotes his tract about this, and then she writes these words herself. At the very time specified, Turkey, which was occupied by the Ottoman Empire, through her ambassadors, accepted the protection of the allied powers of Europe and thus placed herself under the control of Christian nations. Went from a Mohammedan control to a Christian control. Then she adds this statement of her own. The event exactly fulfilled the prediction. The event exactly fulfilled the prediction. So far as she herself was concerned, she was corroborating his prediction. On August 11, 1840, when this actually happened, the ministers and theologians who'd argued about this day for a year principle were all whipped, every one of them, and silenced. There was no more argument unless they were just, you know, almost totally ignorant. Everyone had to accept the day for a year when a man stuck his neck out so far, you know, as to predict 2 years in advance on that principle what would happen, and it happened. Now, Seventh-day Adventists, you know, have lost some of their confidence in some of these predictions. Too bad we didn't live in the 1840s and suffer some of the agony and ridicule of the Advent believers when they were predicting what would happen in 1844. And even though they missed the event, there was plenty of evidence that they did not miss the time. Isn't that right? Plenty of evidence. In the whole world, literally, evidence they did not miss the time. Just misunderstood the event. The disciples had the same mistake, did they not? They made the same mistake. They didn't believe Christ would be crucified at all. But they knew the time of his coming, but not the event that would take place. But still, they were his disciples and his true followers. This idea of a day for a year in Bible prophecy has really done something for Seventh-day Adventism. It really has, and other people are aware of it. Thinking Christians in all denominations are aware that Seventh-day Adventists have had a foundation in prophecy that no one else has. And I do not think that we sufficiently appreciate the background the Lord has given to us, the heritage, the foundation that he's given to us. Nowadays, we take them for granted because so many grew up in the Advent faith or learned them and have been around a long, long time and assume that they're easy to understand. And they're sort of just, you know, not too important anymore. And we just drift along, assuming that we understand it and we have it. So what? Well, a God who would be so careful, you know, as to plan these things all in advance, write them down thousands of years in advance, and then teach them at the right time to the right people, counting on them to do a job for him. You know, he really has great care. It's like a father who plans for the future of his children and plans almost every day, every step of their life, because he's so solicitous for their welfare and care. They have the privilege of doing what they want to, but he provides for them. And in this great strife mentioned here in these chapters on the seals and on the trumpets, the great troubles and temptations and deceptions that come along, the Lord is still there unfolding the scroll, unrolling the scroll, so to speak, the great maker and master of history. He really is. Who is the controller of kings and kingdoms and of everything in the earth, who permits some of these things to happen in order to be a God of justice and mercy as well, who doesn't dictate that it should happen sometimes, but is the overruler of all things, is he not, the affairs of men. And it'll be evident one of these days that everything is in his hand. Is it not? Everything. And if anything were made plain, it's true in these prophecies that he just so completely has a grasp of all these things, way in advance, predicting exactly what would transpire and telling us about them so we could understand and be forewarned. As you sit and look at these, you notice that the time of the sixth seal, the sixth trumpet, is predicted quite accurately, at least generally, in verse 13 of chapter 9. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God. This tells you something. The ministry of the Lord was not yet in the most holy place, according to this verse. It was still in the holy place. The transition that took place on October 22, 1844, when he carried his ministry into the most holy place, had not transpired yet. He was still in the apartment where they had the four horns of the golden altar, and great controversy makes it very plain that this is speaking of the, in page 414 and 15, this is speaking of the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. So the voice comes from there. Now notice that, as I told you, these are probably warlike military events. Notice why some of this terrible destruction takes place in the last two verses of chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of their work, of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their theft. In spite of all the hand of the Lord overruling in these affairs, they still are unrepentant. Just like down in the plagues, in the fifth plague, they will not repent. These do not repent either. No matter what the Lord does to reveal himself, they're unrepentant. People wonder why God permits some of these terrible things to happen to men. The only reason why is in hopes that perhaps some of them would change their minds. But people can get to the condition where nothing will change them. Nothing from heaven will change them. And I wonder sometimes these days if we are not in danger of getting so lethargic, so stupefied, literally, so numb and insensitive, so unthinking, so lukewarm and calloused, that no matter how the Spirit of God bombards our minds and our senses, we are still insensible. We still do not think. It doesn't seem to penetrate, and it doesn't seem to transform or change. When I study back how the old-timers used to respond to some of these prophecies, how quick they were, and what an insight they had, you know. And then I look at myself even, and others, and I think, my, how thick we are, you know. How slow and how dull. And yet we think we are the bright generation, don't we? That we're the intellectual age, the age of light. I really doubt that we are many, many times. Now, before the seventh angel sounds his trumpet, come down to Revelation chapter 10, another angel intervenes here between the sounding of the sixth trumpet and the seventh. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head. His face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. Spirit prophecy tells us this was Jesus, quite definitely. He had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot on the earth, and cried with a loud voice as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. When the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. Now this is a whole different sealing than the portions of the book of Daniel that were sealed. These were not even written down. Isn't that right? Those in Daniel written down, but sealed up so you couldn't understand them. These were sealed so you couldn't understand them and not even written down. They weren't even uttered. They uttered them. He said, seal them up and don't write them down. How can you understand what's not been written? This seems like one of the vaguest parts of all the Bible. You know, how in the world can you find out what this is? Is it possible? The spirit of prophecy is marvelous, and when you read it, you'll find some answers that tell you things that are very logical. She tells us what these seven thunders uttered. Did you know that? How many knew that, by the way? Good, there are a few students here. That's nice. Congratulations. The rest of you ought to read where they read. Found in Volume 7 of the Commentaries, Bible Commentaries, Volume 7, page 971. The special light given to John, which was expressed in the seven thunders, was a delineation of the events which would transpire on the first and second angels' messages. Seven thunders now. Special light given to John, which was expressed in the seven thunders, was a delineation of the events which would transpire under the first and second angels' messages. Now, that transpired back probably between 1840 and 1844, events there. And it's described in early writings quite vividly, pages 232 to 240. One chapter called the First Angel's Message, another one called the Second Angel's Message. And she limits to those two messages primarily, not including the third. She continues there, it was not best for the people to know these things, for their faith must necessarily be tested. In the order of God, most wonderful and advanced truths would be proclaimed. The first and second angels' messages were to be proclaimed, but no further light was to be revealed before these messages had done their specific work. So the Lord did not reveal what would happen on the preaching of those two messages, and no light would be given on them except those two messages until they'd done their work. Now, since they had done their work, she was permitted to talk about them, you see, and the Lord showed her about this, because it was already accomplished back in those days. And if you read there about the people refusing to come up to this first step, you see, and then the second step, and how people doubted this and all the problems they had in those days, it's a very interesting thing that took place in the preaching of the first and second angels' messages back in the days prior to 1844. So these seven thunders are most interesting things, and just describe the events, and you can probably read the same events that they would have spoken about had they permitted to do this, in early writings there in those two chapters. Now we're told quite a bit about this angel that has the seven thunders, when he cried seven thunders out of their voices, about the angel in Revelation 10 verses 1 and 2. And the symbolism there where he had in his hand a little book open, he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot on the earth. In Reflective Messages book 2, page 107 and 108, it says, the message of Revelation 14, you know those messages, or the three of those messages, proclaiming that the hour of God's judgment has come, the first especially, is given in the time of the end. And the angel Revelation 10, this is the one here you see, is represented as having one foot on the sea and one foot on the land, showing that the message will be carried to distant lands, the ocean will be crossed, and the islands of the sea will hear the proclamation of the last message of warning to our world. In the Adventist Commentary, Volume 7, page 971, it says, this position denotes supreme power and authority over the whole earth. Over the whole earth. Now, that's quite important. When you recall that Mohammedanism had literally swept around the earth, you see, at least halfway around the earth. And now you see him after this power has been destroyed and fallen in the sixth trumpet, you see, and before the seventh, which is a unique one, just prior to that. Here he is standing, one foot on the sea and one foot on the land, you see, symbolizing his supreme authority over the whole earth, and that his message would go all over the earth, you see. This is what is connoted by this. Page 971 of Volume 7 of the Commentaries also says, the angel's position with one foot on the sea and the other on the land signifies the wide extent of the proclamation of the message. It will cross the broad waters and be proclaimed in other countries, even to all the world. Even to all the world. Now this is an intervening angel here. And notice the seventh trumpet, what it's like following this angel in verse 7 of chapter 10. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he has declared to his servants the prophets. The mystery of God is probably the preaching of the gospel to all the world. And he said it should be finished. And the three angels' message began to be preached back there in the 1840s. And literally he was predicting, as it says in Revelation 14, you know, that it would go to every kindred, nation, tongue, and people. An angel flying in the midst of heaven, taking it speedily around the earth to all peoples, and no one left out. And so after it appeared that the Christian gospel message had languished, you see, and gone out in darkness of the dark ages, and another message come in to take its place and sweep the earth, and the Christianity be crowded out and probably die out as the way it appeared for a while. The Lord said here in the prophecies, that's not the way it's going to be. These other religions are going to be snuffed out. And the true message, the mystery of godliness, you see, this mystery of the seventh trumpet, it's going to be sounded in all the world. And it's going to be taken all around the earth. And it's depicted by his standing on the land and on the sea. For he is the one in authority who has sent this message for us to preach. Now there are a few more symbols found there in verses 5 and 6 of that chapter. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand, lifted his hand to heaven, and swore by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things that there are therein, that there should be time no longer. Now, when you study all of this and begin to put this back into its proper place, and realize that the sixth trumpet was fulfilled in 1840, at this crisis time of the preaching of the Advent message, when the first, second, and third angels were just beginning to come into their own, actually, you see, in just a year or so time. And here he said there'd be time no longer after, he said, this mystery of God should be finished. You see, and taken to all earth, evidently. And then at this time, time no longer. What does that mean? In the Selected Messages, book 2, page 108, found a quotation on this, and I want to read a couple about it that help to describe it in great detail. It says, this message announces the end of prophetic periods. First message should be time no longer, Revelation 10, verses 5 and 6. This message announces the end of the prophetic period. The disappointment of those who expected to see our Lord in 1844 was indeed bitter and so on. And so it's the end of this time, you see, that was taking place. And as you read down there in 7 Bible Commentary, page 971, the time which the angel declares with a solemn oath is not the end of the world's history, neither a probationary time, but a prophetic time, which should precede the advent of our Lord. That is, the people of God will not have another message upon definite time. After this period of time, reaching from 1842 to 44, there can be no definite tracing of the prophetic time. No definite tracing of prophetic time. So there are no time prophecies after 1844, to our understanding. And there it discusses also about this long prophecy of the 2300 days or years ending on October 22nd, 1844. Now, it doesn't say there will be no more prophecies, does it? No more time prophecies. The Lord doesn't limit the time after that, apparently, for some reason or other. We don't know about the statute of limitations regarding time. But there are many events. And so after 1844, we find out where we are chronologically by the events that have transpired fulfilling prophecies and by the unfulfilled prophecies. And we find our places there in several areas, especially in Revelation, where the prophecies have already been fulfilled, but there are some in the future that have not been. And so there we are, betwixt and between, are we not? Waiting for the future events and looking back on the past prophecies that have transpired. So time would be no longer, and this is pronounced here in this unique context between the sixth and the seventh trumpets. Sixth and seventh trumpets. The sixth ending definitely in 1840, and the seventh probably beginning to sound just about that time. And of course, the Lord has predicted in the prophecies that this message would go around the earth, isn't that right? Until finally, every nation, kindred, tongue, and people would have heard it, and it would be taken care of. Now, along with this is found a unique prophecy about a little book. And you go back there to verse 2, it says he had in his hand a little book open. Not a closed book, but an open book. A little book open. And as you read on down there in verse 8 and onward, and the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again and said, go and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel, which standeth upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went unto the angel and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said unto me, take it and eat it up. It shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up. And it was in my mouth sweet as honey, but as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And he said unto me, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Most Adventists have studied about this little book for years and don't have too much trouble with it. What is the little book that was sealed and now is open? Was it Daniel? Yes, it's only a part of Daniel. That's right. We're getting real touchy here tonight, so don't mind, will you? It wasn't the whole book of Daniel that was sealed, not at all. For most of the book of Daniel was wide open and always had been, hadn't it? It wasn't the whole book that was sealed by any means, just a portion of it. In Advent's Commentary, Volume 7, page 971, after these seven thunders uttered their voices, the injunction comes to John as to Daniel in regard to the little book. Seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered. These relate to future events which will be disclosed in their order. Daniel shall stand in his lot at the end of the days. John sees the little book unsealed. Then Daniel's prophecies have their proper place in the first, second, and third angels' messages to be given to the world. The unsealing of the little book was the message in relation to time. A message in relation to time. You see, when Daniel fainted, the portion you didn't understand was about the fourth beast and the time elements. When you come to Daniel chapter 9, they begin to explain about the time. Isn't that true? Portions of it. But this is the part that was sealed pertaining to time. For it was an astounding thing that time would last that long. And that all the things prophesied there in Daniel chapter 8 should take all that time before they were taken care of. It's unbelievable. It's a shocking thing. And the events that took place after Christ ascended to heaven and the time when finally the book was opened, you see, down in 1798 and onward, 1844, if we knew all those things in advance, you live back in Daniel's day, what would you have said? They knew all about the dark ages and all about the persecutions and the martyrs and how the truth would seem to almost go out in darkness. And all these things, terrible things that would happen, what would you say? It's so long, what's the use of trying? Isn't that right? Why even think about it anymore? Why have any hope? So the Lord's hand was over this, and now the book was opened up at the right time when people needed to understand this. And it's amazing that a man like William Miller should sit down there by himself, a farmer, 50 years of age, with a large family and a very poor man. And while a fair education is surely, it was not a theologian's education. He should sit down with a Cruden's Concordance and a Bible. And there he should begin to study chronology, time prophecies of the Bible. He had 18 time prophecies. I'm not saying they're all accurately understood, by which he could establish what was coming in 1843 or 44. 18. I have a copy of them at home. I've read, kept them in my files. 18 of them. If you can find one or two, you know you're doing quite well. This man had 18. He used to preach on all of them. He really convinced people he was right. He knew how to do it. But think of the time he took to study. And think of how the Lord must have led him. And look at the great light that came on God's people after that disappointment. It would be sweet first, you see, but then bitter. They thought the Lord was going to come, and they looked forward with great anticipation and excitement and joy. He didn't come. And they had that bitter disappointment, as it's called, and he didn't show up. But then the prophet said in verse 11, thou must prophesy again before many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. Prophesy again. They'd done great preaching in those days and had gone many, many places in the earth, if we understand great controversy correctly. Over in the Middle East, in Europe, down in South America, we understand it was there, in many, many places up in the Scandinavian countries. And yet, he said, prophesy again. Do you suppose they ever dreamed they'd go as far as they've gone today? You know, you have to travel to find out what Adventism really means. And I think you have to travel as a missionary, not as a tourist. It makes a difference. When you travel as a tourist, you're not exactly looking for what a missionary looks for, and you're not treated like a missionary. But let me tell you, around the earth they know Seventh-day Adventist missionaries. We're as well known as any other missionaries on all the earth, if not better known. I shall never forget when we landed in Cape Town, South Africa, 5 o'clock in the evening, and sundown at 8 o'clock that night, and you had to go through a long customs procedure, you know, and checking your visa and everything, and you had imaginations of maybe getting through the midnight that night on the Sabbath, and the, you know, those boats just take a long, long time. They park, you know, like parking an ocean almost. They move so slowly, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. They're never in a hurry with a ship. It didn't seem like the ones I was on, they were in a hurry at least. We wonder how he gets through there. But there's a man waiting for us, Elder Bannister, some of you know him there. And they had sent a message ahead of us, you see, that we were coming. He was waiting for us. In fact, he'd been down there for 3 days looking for us. And when he found out our ship was coming in, he went down to customs and made arrangements with the Cook's Agency. Many of you know about them. And he knew it was Sabbath, and so he and his wife had gone and got an apartment for us, fixed it all up, had the food there because we knew we'd have no time to get our food. And he said, if you just check your visa through here with a customs man, he said, I'll get you through customs down on the warehouse they have there. He said, just get the suitcase you need for a weekend until Monday morning. We'll come back and get the rest of your things. We were on the ship with missionaries. All the other families were missionaries. One of the families were South African. They're coming to their home country. They'd lived there for years, and the man had been born there. We checked our visas through with the rest. Didn't take very long. We took our suitcases down the gangplank, you know, walked in there, and Elder Bannister went up and said, these are the folk I was telling you about. And he said, oh, yes, open your suitcases. And just like that, bang, bang, bang. And we walked out of there with all the people standing there, and on Monday I found out they were there for 3 or 4 hours. Even the fellow who was a native of that land, still there. I've heard the story of one of our general conference men who got on an airplane going to the Far East via Europe. Got on Washington, D.C., and he sat with a stranger, and they began to visit along the way and introduce themselves by name, but not by occupation or profession. They landed, I believe, in England, and when they landed, they had a little break there. The plane had to refuel, and so they got off the plane, and here was a delegation waiting for this man from the general conference. And they had a nice visit, you know, and the cafe there and so on, and came on the plane an hour or so later, and they went on, and I think they landed in Rome the next time, and here was another delegation waiting for him. I think they landed in Beirut the next time, another delegation waiting for him, and after that, this other fellow sitting with him, and they sat back down in the seats again to take off for the next stop, he said, would you please tell me who in the world you are? And he said, yes, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist minister. You are. He could hardly believe it. He said, you know who I am? And he said, no. He said, I'm a representative of the President of the United States. And there's been no one to meet me where we've gone. Not a soul. It's a fact. No one to meet me. And every place you land, there's someone to see you. He said, you must be the most important man in all the world. He said, nobody even cares about me, but somebody's out there to meet you every time. You'll find out this is true wherever you go in the world. There's always someone waiting for you. Isn't that true? There's several missionaries sitting here. There's always someone waiting for you. You can go on the backside of creation someplace where you don't think anyone's ever been, and they know about Seventh-day Adventists. Now, to make this really stark real to you, with these other missionaries on our boat, you know, this one man from South Africa, his baby had a very high temperature when we left New York City in the boat. And the mother was a nurse and took care of the baby but couldn't get the temperature down. Mm-hmm. Had the child in the bathtub and so on and so forth and everything under the sun. Finally, when we were about a day and a half out of Trinidad, Port of Spain, many of you have been there, they radioed ahead, the captain did, for some doctor to come out and meet us. And I heard about this, and so I went to this fellow and I said, would you like to have an Adventist doctor? And I wasn't sure he would, you know, come and meet the boat and take care of your baby. And he said, you mean a Christian doctor? I said, well, I think so. He's a Seventh-day Adventist. We have a hospital there. You do? How do you know? And I had the yearbook along. And so I gave him the cable number, you know, and so the captain called there. And Dr. and Mrs. Bull, and she's also a physician, many of you know them, came out to meet the boat at midnight that night in a little small boat there. They took the mother and daughter to their house because the hospital closed that night and they wanted to take good care of the baby. And they had 6 doctors look at that baby. We went in the next morning to be with them. And they found out the baby was allergic to the myosins they were giving it for the cold the baby had had. And when they found out that the physician who discovered this, by the way, was a Negro. this South African man had quite a few second thoughts. He didn't think they were capable of doing this, but the other five white doctors couldn't find out what was wrong with this child. And this Negro, who was a pediatrician, just took one look at the child and said, "What medicine are you giving the child?" He really had a new experience, this man, you know. And so we had pulled out there at noon that day and were on the high seas of the Central and South Atlantic for a long time. And we were standing up on the railing one day, watching the seagulls off there in the distance, and way, way off in the distance, you could barely see a pile of rocks. And it's a famous place, made famous by a man, and his name was Napoleon. You know what the pile of rocks was now, it's St. Helena Island. And so this fellow said to me, for I've said a lot about Adventists since the time of Port of Spain, you know, and he said, "I suppose you have some missionaries there too?" And I said, "Yes, we do. You want to find out?" And he said, "Well, I doubt it." And I showed him we have one church on the island of St. Helena. We do. And it's been there for many, many years. And there was in our yearbook just as big as could be. If you could see how small that pile of rocks is, and how difficult it is to find out there in the middle of that enormous ocean, you'd say, what people would ever go to a place like that? But somebody has gone there years and years ago. I'm not trying to brag up Seventh-day Adventists because I think we ought to be criticized. If ever were there a day when we're not going with all the people we have able to go, this is the day. And we have to call dozens and dozens of families, literally, to go to some place out there to stay. And when we used to have to go, you know, 10, 12 years before we ever come home. And now, if they go longer than 3 or 6 months, you know, and they call that a tour of duty. And this is true. We can't get people to leave home or relatives or professions or whatever it be for any length of time to go to a dying world. We ought to be criticized. But the prophecies of the Lord found here are literally true already. We have by no means gone to every people. Not by any means whatsoever. But it's amazing how far we have gone and how true this prophecy is. You know, when you live in the mission lands and find the spirit of missionaries passed on to the people once heathen in those lands, and see them going as missionaries after missionaries have come to them, and discover the harassment and persecution they undergo when they go to some of these places out there in Africa and other places where they're called foreign devils, even though they have the same color skin, you know, and where they're persecuted severely. And you watch them go and go happily, and watch them how they live, you know, just literally almost nothing for a salary, never knowing where the next meal is coming from sometimes. And then you see us living in all our comfort here, you know, stateside, and only working diligently to get more of what we already have. It makes you wonder, you know, if the missionaries are still living in the United States. It really makes you wonder. Or if they're all in the other lands. And when you see the growth in Central America, South America, India, where it was said we would never grow, you see, because of so much opposition. And you see how fast they're growing today, how rapidly, until they're actually surpassing us, outstripping us. The biggest conference is no longer the United States, you know. The biggest conference is down there in South America. And practically in one city, the heaviest populated Adventist conference. And the largest population of Adventists is not in the United States per mile geographically by any means. You go over down to Jamaica or Rwanda where we were, where you have mission stations with 50,000 Adventists or adherents, you see. And 100,000 in one little country you can hardly find on a map that's so small. And see people at the campings they have out there by the tens of thousands and converts by the thousands, you know. And you say, we thought all the Adventists were in the United States. They just walked off and left us. These prophecies tell me that it's time for us to get moving, you know that? It's time to get moving. When the Lord said, go into all the world and preach the gospel, he meant go. He didn't mean stay. And the stayers somehow haven't found out what these prophecies are all about. They might have a mental understanding of them, but they sure haven't found the spirit of going and telling around the earth. They just haven't found out. And the spirit of sacrifice and denial that was required to go to all these people because the love of Christ constrains us We can't stay home. We can't sit down. And we can't stay there resting and accumulating while these people are going to suffer and die and lose everything. And we have so much to give. Something has to change, you know, here. How can you get 5 or 6 or 7 thousand Adventists in a community like this? How is it humanly possible for Adventists to cluster up like this and call themselves Adventists? Adventists are the ones who are going to go, you know, not stay. How can you accumulate that many in one place? Adventists. Are they Adventists if they stay and not go? It's impossible. It's an impossibility. They are not Seventh-day Adventists that they're staying. Now, I understand that some are too old to go and too feeble and too sickly to go. But all of us are not like this, you know. And can't even get some of us to go across the street anymore. These prophecies are written to so inspire us and so compel us, you know, that we just can't stay. We just can't stay. We've got to go. And the Lord is calling for people today who will help to fulfill the seventh trumpet, when the mystery of God should be finished and taken to all the world, when we'll prophesy again and we'll take this glorious news around the earth to all these hungry people who have so little and almost nothing when it comes to an understanding of the gospel we have. If ever the Lord were shouting like seven thunders, whenever that language, those adjectives found in Revelation 10 were true, of thundering and lightning like a lion roaring, you know. The Lord is saying today, go, isn't that right? Move, preach, do something, but don't stay still. Don't stand still. Don't stay here. Go! And the Lord is trying to give us an eviction notice, not from the earth, you know, but from staying put. Now's the time to go. And Revelation screams us from the housetops, doesn't it? Go into all the world and preach the gospel. And when this is done, then shall the end come, you see. Then shall the end come. Are we longing for Jesus to come? Do we love the precious one who gave us this marvelous light and so much hope in our hearts? If we do, we love all the souls for whom he died. And we cannot bear to see one of them lost. Not bear. And we will go. We will deny ourselves and we will give and do everything humanly possible so that every soul can be gathered in. And then the Lord will say, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. May that be the sweet music for your ears, is my prayer in his name.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest collection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.